It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. So, as you know, there were four talks of Suzuki Roshi's given in the very early days of his being in America that were recently found in his archives. And I've been substituting those four talks for a talk that I had already written and prepared for you. But I want to be sure that you get his actual words that are just so precious and that you won't come across them, you know, just like in a book. So today is going to be, I think, the third time that I'm substituting. And then I think the eighth talk will also be a substitution. The subject is Wisdom Seeks for Wisdom, and I'm just going to read to you Suzuki Roshi's words to his students in Marion Darby's living room Zendo in about 1961 or two or something like that. We are studying now the Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch in the evening lecture, and prajna. This is, of course, Sanskrit word. Now we mean is wisdom, but this wisdom is not intellect or knowledge. This intellect, wisdom is so called it, our inmost nature, which is always in incessant activity. Zen practice is to wisdom seeking for wisdom is Zazen practice. Wisdom seeking for wisdom is Zazen practice, if I use a technical term. Wisdom seeks wisdom is Zazen practice, and our everyday life is wisdom. Realization of our precepts is our everyday life. When our everyday life is based on wisdom, we call it precepts. When we sit, we do not do anything, we just sit. There's no activity of our mind, we just sit, and all what we do is taking, inhaling and exhaling. Sometimes you will hear some birds singing, but that is not actually, you are not hearing. Your ears will hear, but you are not hearing it. Just, you know, sound come and you make some respond to it, that's all. This kind of practice is called wisdom seek for wisdom. We have true nature. Whatever you do, even though you do not do anything, your true nature is in incessant work or activity. Even though you are sleeping, it is quite active. Your thinking or your sensation are superficial activity of yourself, but inmost nature is always working. Even though you die, it is working. I don't mean, you know, soul, but something, not soul, but something is always in incessant work. Whatever you call it, spirit or soul, I don't mind, and he laughs. You can put many names to it, or you will give it various interpretation to it, but that interpretation belongs to in your intellectuality. That is intellect. So whatever you call it, inmost nature itself doesn't mind. Someone may call it soul, someone may call it spirit, Someone might say, oh, no, that's just material. Some kind of function of material is soul. Maybe. According to the, people, they will put many names on it. But our inmost nature is our inmost nature. It is quite little to do with our inmost nature. So he's saying all these names have very little to do with our inmost nature. We just have inmost nature and it's incessant. It has incessant activity, no matter what you call it. When we sit, we call it inmost. That inmost nature in itself, or activity. This is, we call self-use of inmost nature. Let it work. You don't do anything, but let our true nature work by itself. This is Zen practice. Of course, even though you do not do anything, you will have pain in your legs or some difficulty to keep your mind calm. And sometimes you may think, oh, my Zazen is not so good. That is also the activity of inmost nature, you know. Not your activity, but the activity of your true nature. Not your activity, the activity of your true nature. Your true nature says, your Zazen is not so good, and he laughs. If he says so, you should just accept it. So, not so good. What are you thinking? Stop thinking stop thinking. This is Zen. When you do something, it is a kind of morality that in it. So there's a kind of morality in it, he means. It is because you do something by your choice. But when you make decision to do something, your inmost nature will tell you, that will not be so good. Why don't you do it this way? This is precepts, you know, when we have some choice in our activity. In Zazen, we have no choice. We just sit and whatever inmost nature say, let it do it. I don't mind. This is Zazen. But when you make some plan, you are responsible for it too. At that time, you should listen to what your inmost nature will say. That is morality or precepts. Our inmost nature will tell you what to do. So if you understand this way, this is morality or this is precepts. So the precepts actually is not only two, or 200, or 50, or 500. For female, we have 500 precepts, and for male, 250. That is not so fair, he laughs anyway. Anyway, 500 or 300, it doesn't matter. Whatever we do is precepts because we have some choice. We have to make some decision. So he's kind of making a distinction. We have our basic inmost nature that's always active, and it's always with us no matter what we do. And when we make a choice about what we do, we're bringing our precepts to bear on our choice. That's when our precepts become active in the kind of morality behind our decisions of how to behave. Then Suzuki Roshi says, I am responsible for it, what I should do. And when we make some decision, we listen to Buddha nature. What should I do? That's all. So here you have, in your everyday life, you have precepts and you have freedom too. Whatever you do, it is up to you. As long as you have freedom, you yourself make some decision, so you should be responsible for that. You do not say, Buddha should be responsible for it. I don't mind, I'm not responsible for that. You cannot say so in your everyday life. So in our everyday life, we should have precepts. We should observe the precepts instead of leaving responsibility to Buddha. We should be responsible for that, but at the same time, you have freedom. There is no need for you to be bound by precepts. Precepts is formulated by your own choice. As long as you take conscious activity, there is freedom, and at the same time, you should be responsible for that. This is freedom, true freedom. To leave all responsibility to Buddha is not freedom. I don't mind. Someone may say, whatever you do, that is Buddha nature. It doesn't matter what you do. So he's saying, some people say, well, it's Buddha nature, so I'm not responsible and it doesn't matter what I do. And Roshi is saying, this is a misunderstanding. But the morality without Buddha nature is just moral code, and you will be enslaved by moral code. That is a rigid moral code in which you will be enslaved. But if you become aware of Buddha nature, innate nature, that is freedom. That is not rigid precepts. You do it by your own choice, and you do it by your true nature, according to your true nature. So that is complete freedom. And that is also morality. So in this sense, you have freedom. You are not enslaved by Buddha nature, by a moral code. And moral code is not always the same. It is not permanent. Strictly speaking, there is a moral code whatever you do. So we say Zen and precepts is one. In everyday life, we call it precepts. And in practice of Zazen, we call it Zen. So Zen and everyday life should be self-use of our true nature. So in this sense, precepts and Zen is not different. This is a very important point. So this idea of self-use of our true nature, it's very important. We bow this morning 9 times. Why we bow to Buddha is, it is actually a kind of practice to get rid of our self-centered idea, to give ourselves completely to Buddha. Here I mean to give myself or ourselves means our physical function and our intellectual function or life, physical and intellectual life to Buddha, because it is based on Buddha nature. So even though we forget all about it, still we have Buddha nature here. So Buddha bows to Buddha. That is a bow. This is one meaning. So when you bow to Buddha, it's not you bowing to Buddha, it's Buddha bowing to Buddha. And another meaning is, as long as we live, we have body here and we have to think something. So Buddha practiced Zen and we practice Zen. So everyone, when he practiced Zen, they are called Buddha. And Buddha mind or Bodhisattva mind is a spirit. To attain oneness in duality is, in short, our spirit. Because we are not so good, you know, we try to improve ourselves. That is our true nature. And we are aware of it. We have some intention to improve ourselves. This intention is limited to human being. Flowers come up. A flower may come out in spring without fail, but they do not, you know, make any effort. They automatically come out, that's all. We try to open, you know, our flower in spring. We try to do right things at the right time, but we find it very difficult. In this sense, we are very stupid. And he laughs. even though we try to do it, we cannot make it. But this is our human nature. We always try to do something. We always have some difficulty to do something. But this point is very important for us. This is why we have pleasure of human being, because it is difficult and we are always making some effort. That effort results in our human pleasure of life, our pleasure of human life, he says. This pleasure is limited to human being, and this is called our true nature. I think he's saying that our true nature is this constant effort to improve ourselves. That's just the nature of human beings. And he says it's our pleasure, actually. But if you understand this true nature, you will find out the true nature within yourself and in every existence. Flower has this nature. Even though it is cold, they are preparing for spring. Even though they do not know, they are making good effort to come up in spring. So this, when we become aware of it, we will know that this nature we have is universal nature to every existence. But this awareness of true nature is limited to human beings. So everyone has true nature, but only human beings are aware of it. So this awareness is very important. And this awareness is, in short, to try to do something good. That's our spirit. We don't know why we should try to improve ourselves. No one knows. There is no reason for it, or it is beyond discussion. Even though you cannot discuss why, it is the nature. It is our true nature, and it is so big. It is out of comparison, out of our intellectual understanding. So it doesn't make any sense, even though you discuss it. What are you talking about? He laughs. Those who are aware of it will laugh at you if you discuss about it. Good or bad, why? Why is it so? And it's a big problem to talk about it, to discuss. This is why we bow to Buddha. He talks a little now about posture, but I'm going to skip over that part. So that's the end of that talk. Before I share some of the comments on this talk made by a group of Zen priests and senior students, I'd like to share some comments made about Suzuki Roshi by Chogyam Trungpa, who was Roshi's friend and regarded him highly, calling Roshi his accidental father. He said, Roshi's style is in the direct experience of living Zen. All his gestures are naked and to the point, like the burning tip of an incense stick. His whole being testifies to what it means to live in the reality of the moment. He has uncanny perspicacity. He is so in tune, so in touch with you. Those were Trungpa's words. Many people commented on Suzuki Roshi's quality of intimacy, saying that it is the heartbeat of Zen. And Trungpa acknowledged Roshi as the founder of the first practice site outside of Asia. Others noted Roshi saying that even Buddha was practicing Zen. That's a very unusual statement, that even Buddha was practicing Zen, because that word Zen, I don't think, was around in Buddha's time. But looking back, even Buddha was practicing Zen. They spoke of his humility, this is his being Suzuki Roshi's, They spoke of Suzuki Roshi's humility of being a human being. We need 500 precepts, whereas flowers just come up. You know, human beings are just really difficult. And Roshi was the humblest in the face of his pain. You know, he died of cancer. Pancreatic cancer, I'm not sure. And he was in a lot of pain and he didn't take medicine. And it said he melted into kindness and was connected to everyone. He just gave himself up. Embodiment is the key to practice, he said. At Eheiji, they bow 3 times. Students of Suzuki Roshi bow 9 times in order to develop this humbleness and selflessness. So those are short comments that people made about Roshi. And then other students offered more involved commentary. And I share those with you too. First of all, there was a reminder about Suzuki Roshi's English, especially at that time. This student said that he came to America in 1959 when he was 55 years old, and he died in 71. So he was here a total of 12 years. Oh, so these 4 talks, I mistook them. These 4 talks were given in 1965, right in the middle. So he came in 59. The talks that I'm giving you, that are these 4 talks that were just found, were in 65 and he died in 71. They were given to a group of 10 to 12 people who maybe sat once a week. He was relaxed and speaking as if to a group of friendly beginners. And the second student says that many people have commented on the intimacy of his connection with the group to whom he was speaking. And this intimacy is called the heartbeat of Zen. The third student said, since Zazen is the activity of our inmost nature, if our true inmost nature says, your Zazen is not so good, we should accept it. Because whatever it is our Zazen. So just accept what your inmost nature says about it. Not to get into an intellectual discussion about whether it's good or bad. Let it be. So not so good? Oh, okay. I guess my Zazen is not so good then. Oh, well. So not if I do X, it will be better or even worse. So we shouldn't say, well, if I do this, then my Zazen will get better. Or worse is, I guess I'm just not cut out for Zazen, so maybe I should stop. Roshi is saying not to get involved intellectually, even with your inmost nature's judgment of your Zazen. I hope that's clear. That's really helpful. So a lot of us do this, you know. Ugh, that was a terrible period of Zazen. You know, maybe I'm not cut out for Zazen, or my Zazen is miserable. And this student is saying that Roshi is saying, don't argue with your inmost nature. If your inmost nature is saying your Zazen is not so good, just accept that. Okay, well, my Zazen isn't so good. Okay, you know, I'm still gonna do Zazen, but I guess it's not so good. So anyway, it doesn't matter. That should be our attitude. Then the fourth student says, regarding Buddha nature, notice that Roshi uses the word aware if we become aware of our inmost nature. We act by our own choice and our own true nature, which is both freedom and morality. Strictly speaking, he says, there is morality to everything. I would say it's more like there is a correctness to everything that your inmost nature knows. And if you turned into that, you will always behave properly. So there's a correctness about everything that your inmost nature knows. And if you turn into that correctness, just allow it to be, that will take care of everything and you'll behave properly. When you've turned into that, there's a smoothness and ease about your decisions and the way you handle things. And when you're not tuned into it, there are bumps and dis-ease. But you were following your innate nature, not a rule. A rule doesn't change, but every circumstance is different. So we can't always use the same mindset of the rule. Suzuki Roshi's explanation bases all of our choices on self-attunement. This is truly freedom. It's not the same as saying, well, everyone has Buddha nature, so I can do whatever I want. This is not the same at all. And then the fifth student says, what Roshi is saying about our effort to improve, that making this effort is also our human pleasure. That pleasure is limited to human beings, in that a flower just comes up, but we need 500 precepts to help us figure things out. And this is called our true nature. So our true nature, I guess it, I mean, it needs these 500 precepts to help it out. But if we allow the precepts to work, we can listen to our true nature, and our precepts will be there to guide our behavior so that it's proper. The sixth student said, Roshi took our inmost mind, precepts, freedom, morality, practice, and Buddha nature, and he interwove the whole thing and said, our responsibility is just sit and connect with inmost nature as it is. This is Dogen, aligning the self with the function of the self. Our everything is expressing its enlightenment. We might as well join this inherent, innate part that we share with everything. This is the motor joy of practice. That's very interesting. They're saying Roshi basically threw it all together and says everything is expressing enlightenment, and we may as well enjoy this inherent, innate part that we share with everything. The seventh person said, so our true nature is universal nature shared with all existence, but the awareness of this nature is limited to human beings. This awareness does not extend to why. We do not know why we keep trying always to improve ourselves. This is why we bow to Buddha. We don't know, so we'll just bow. It's good. It gives us something to do. And finally, the last student says, bowing helps us eliminate our self-centered ideas. When he was 11, he being Roshi, when Suzuki Roshi was 11, he chose to leave home and study with a strong, powerful man who was the new abbot of a monastery where his father used to be abbot. His father was this man's teacher, and while he was visiting, 11-year-old Roshi fell in love with him and asked to go with him to study Zen. The abbot was very strict and treated the boys very harshly. There were nine to begin with, but after the first year, four left, and soon after that, another four left, leaving Roshi there alone. One of the practices of this abbot was having them bow nine times instead of three as a means toward eliminating their youthful self-centered ideas. Roshi got that from this teacher, whom he learned to love. So I didn't know that. I thought Roshi invented it when he saw how much Americans needed to bow. But apparently, his first teacher this the teacher who gave him Dharma transmission and was the student of his own father. He was a very strict teacher, and I do remember reading how Roshi was there all alone because everybody, all the other boys left. In Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, there's a section on bowing, and it mentions that when Roshi was in school, so this is in university, he did his thesis on Dogen's fascicle, Receiving the Marrow by Bowing. Roshi's most important teacher. So there was that first teacher who was very harsh. And then later, he studied also with Kishigawa. We've talked about him. He's the teacher who whom Roshi was unable to say no to and had that strange student that he couldn't find housing for and asked Roshi to house him. And the man ended up killing his wife. That's Kishigawa Ian Roshi. And he was a leading Dogen scholar in Japan at that time. There were only two or three or four at the most Dogen scholars at that time. But Kishigawa was the main one, and Dogen and Roshi studied with him and very much admired him and continued studying with him even after he came to America. And he considers Kishigawa his main, the main teacher from whom he really got his true understanding of Zen. And then one of the kinds of understanding he got from Kishigawa was when we bow, we're bowing to ourselves. We bow to Buddha and to the Buddha in us. Reb says what he says and what we can say when we bow. And that is, thank you, I'm sorry, I love you. This covers it all. So when Reb bows, Reb says, thank you, I'm sorry, I love you. Period. And he just repeats that with every bow. And you can also bow mentally, by the way. I actually bow so deeply internally that I get lost in my bow and then suddenly wake up. It's a very, I find a very wonderful way to bow. So here I'm reading some of the most important points from today's talk, but with the idea that sometimes it's a little difficult to understand Suzuki Roshi's English. I mean, you understand it, but his points are not made directly in succinct sentences. So with that in mind today, I'm making these most important points intentionally so that they're made succinctly. These are all Roshi's points, and I'm saying them succinctly so there's no question about what he was saying. So, first of all, wisdom seeks wisdom is Zazen practice, and our everyday life is wisdom. Realization of our precepts is our everyday life. When our everyday life is based on wisdom, we call it precepts. So that was one very important point Roshi made, but he made it piece by piece. So that's the whole thing. Secondly, we have true nature. Whatever you do, even though you do not do anything, your true nature is in incessant work or activity. Even though you are sleeping, it is quite active. Your thinking or your sensation are superficial activity of yourself. But inmost nature is always working. Even though you die, it is working. And the third point, whatever we do is precepts because we have some choice. We have to make some decision. So we need to make a decision, and therefore we use our moral understanding to make decisions. And therefore we're bringing in the precepts in all of our decision-making. But this is really, this is another word for that. And another way to say that is our everyday life is based on wisdom. And we call that precepts. Fourth, but if you come aware of Buddha nature, innate nature, that is freedom. That is not rigid precepts. You do it by your own choice and you do it by your true nature, according to your true nature. So that is complete freedom. And that is also morality. And fifth, strictly speaking, whatever, there is a moral code, whatever you do. So we say Zen and precept is one. In everyday life, we call it precepts. And in the practice of Zazen, we call it Zen. So Zen and everyday life should be based on, should be the self-use of our true nature. So in this sense, precepts and Zen is not different. And lastly, even though we try to do it, we cannot make it. But this is our human nature. We always try to do something. We have always some difficulty to do something. But this point is very important for us. That is why we have the pleasure of human being, because it is difficult and we are always making some effort. That effort results in our human pleasure of life. Our pleasure of human life. This pleasure is limited to human being, and this is called our true nature. And the idea for your reflection during the week, I basically make that same, write out that same quotation I just said. We always try to do something and we always have some difficulty to do something, but this point is important. And this is the pleasure of being a human being. It's difficult and we're always making efforts. But that effort itself is our human pleasure of life. And that this pleasure is limited to human beings and it's called our true nature. So that quotation, I'm saying that this is a key concept for Suzuki Roshi. Please think about what he is saying regarding the value of our effort and connect this to something specific in your own life. For example, have you ever had the experience of trying very hard to do something and then something happens to hinder the result that you were expecting? How did you process this? Did you feel defeated and regret having done it in the first place? Or did the doing of it somehow enhance your life anyway, even though it wasn't in the way you intended. Do you agree with Roshi that effort is our pleasure of human life? Can you see how this kind of effort is called our true nature? So I'm asking you to really, really think about, Roshi is saying this is very important and this is true about us. So when I'm saying, challenge that, do you agree? Do you agree that, you probably agree because you notice it in yourself that we're always making some kind of effort, but is that our pleasure? Is that our true nature? Is that our pleasure of life? Is that pleasure limited to human beings? Because sometimes I watch squirrels in the morning and they're just constantly searching for food, you know, every single second. They never stop. And so they're making perpetual effort too. So is that effort really, I guess Roshi is restricted to human beings, and I guess Roshi is saying the pleasure of that effort is restricted to human beings. So all of this is up for you to consider. What do you think about all of that? And so now I want to ask for questions. And again, please don't waste this opportunity to ask questions about your personal practice. I really want to help you with that so that you can progress in the sincerity and authenticity of your personal practice. So please ask anything that's an obstacle for that, and anything about anything we've said so far in this series or maybe any other series, and of course today. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. The first question that we have is, I loved that point about expressing one's sincerity. Just in every moment to decide that that's what you're doing, to have sincerity and appreciation for what you're doing. How does one remember to do that?
Sincerity is not something that we need to remember. It's something that we do wholeheartedly, with our full being, without multitasking, without listening to music or a podcast or talking on the phone or whatever we do to think we're not wasting time. Sincerity is not doing it that way, but just fully entering one-on-one with your complete concentration and involvement with whatever it is right in front of you. So it's about fully entering your life right now, and whatever makes up your life right now, to do that thing entirely. And the next minute, it could be something altogether different. And I think that this is why community practice is considered so helpful, because if you live in a Zen community, for example, there's a daily schedule and you simply follow the daily schedule like a robot. You don't have to think about anything. You just, oh, 10:15, let's see, it says I should be here. Okay, I'm there. That's where I'm in. You know, I make sure I'm there. Then that's all you have to do is make sure you're wherever the schedule tells you you're supposed to be. So it makes it easier for you to focus on each thing and your attitude of full engagement on each thing. And so your sincerity grows automatically by virtue of rigorously attending to the community schedule. Now you can make your own schedule. You know, if you're a layman, as most of us are, you can make your own schedule and follow it rigorously. And it can even be in blocks of time that you follow rigorously, or it can be in loose blocks of time. You know, in general, in the morning you do this, in the afternoon you do that, in the early evening you do this. It can be like that. But the most important thing is your full presence in everything that you do. And if you're multitasking, you're not doing it. By definition, you're not doing it. And in today's phone mania, whatever you want to call it, a lot of people are not present. And it's painful. It's painful to see that happening to our whole culture. But anyway, that's what sincerity is. And it's not something outside of us that we have to recall. It's something that we innately have if we just base our lives on activating it. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So another question that we just got is, I've heard from various traditions that the general idea of releasing control to Buddha or God or nature is the key to realizing the illusion of self. But in today's talk, Roshi said that this is a misunderstanding. Can you say anything more on this?
I think that Roshi would consider that a misunderstanding because of the dual nature of giving of that experience. If you're giving yourself over to another entity, no matter who it is, including Buddha, then there's me and you. And that's contrary to Zen understanding. So when we bow, we're simply bowing, and it's the Buddha in us, it's our Buddha nature, it's our true nature that's bowing to our true nature. And the subject of today's talk, wisdom seeks for wisdom. It's the wisdom mind in us that seeks the wisdom mind in the universal wisdom mind. And you could say it's the universal wisdom mind that seeks the universal wisdom mind. And there's no duality in that. So it's hard for us to understand because our minds are based in duality. That's why they're so limited. I remember when I first realized that nothing that's truly important can be grasped with the mind. So all this work that we do with our minds, you know, is by definition already less important than what we just grasp with our bodies and with our innate nature. I hope that was clear and that answered your question. Thank you.
Thank you, Kiyu. So the next one that we have is, while talking about doing a thing single-mindedly, I have a friend who's always getting ready for practice by reading. She's got a whole collection of books on Zen and Buddhism. She says she wants to know what she's doing before she commits herself. I can understand how she feels, but you were saying it's beside the point, right?
Right. Zen is not, true understanding of Zen is not available with our minds. So we have to understand it with our bodies. And therefore, there's no way of understanding Zen Buddhism without sitting. We have to sit. We have to take that posture to access the mind that can understand Zen. That said, when we engage in our daily life activities with a Zazen mind, they become a form of Zazen. And so it's not like our daily activities are unimportant, but we can't be slouching through them. We have to be very conscious and alert and ready. A lot of people get very interested in reading about Zen, and they have a whole library of Zen books or Buddhist books, Buddhist studies, and it's very interesting. There's no question about that. But they substitute that for Zazen. But in actuality, although study is important as a support, because it is interesting and it explains things. So that's what that means. That's why we do such and such and so forth. It doesn't replace the doing the such and such. We still need to do the things. I always go back to what Suzuki Roshi said when I was practicing with him. The mind needs food, so we feed it. That's why we have study period. At Tassajara, there was an hour study period every day after breakfast. The mind needs food, so we feed it. That's the long and short of it. It's not like, oh, this is so important. This is the most important thing we do all day. It's totally not like that. But it is a support. And the mind does need food, so we do feed it. And that's the long and short of it. I think that's the best explanation I've ever heard about Buddhist studies. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. And the next one we have is, does Roshi really mean that there is no need to remember what I say?
A couple of talks ago, I don't remember exactly when, but I was saying about, I was giving you an example of Dogen, actually. So this was a talk when I was saying that there's no more benefit to for me giving a talk to you than for you being the listener to the talk that I'm giving. Both of us, the giver of the talk and the listener to the talk, are fully engaged in the activity, the ritual of a Dharma talk. So a Dharma talk is a ritual, and some person gives the Dharma talk, and then some person listens to the Dharma talk. That's the long and short of it. So there's talking and there's listening happening. That's all. So there's talking, and you don't have to go any further than that. There's talking and there's listening. And it's in the context of a Dharma talk. So this is a respectful sharing of Buddhism. Now, Dogen was so extreme, you know, Dogen went to extremes to make points. And the extreme that he went to make this point was to had all his monks assembled in the Dharma hall, and Dogen was going to give his Dharma hall discourse, which is a Dharma talk. So he arrives and he says, now I'm going to give a Dharma hall discourse, and we've been doing this for centuries, and da da da. There's the end of the Dharma hall discourse. Thank you very much. So he left out the discourse. He just arrived and announced that he was going to give a Dharma hall discourse. And then he announced that he has just given a Dharma hall discourse, and that he thanks people. He saw that they were listening. And so thank you very much. And that's the extreme of saying, this is just a ritual. I'm here to talk and you're here to listen. Talking is happening, listening is happening, so that the ritual is happening. End of story. So yes, there's no need to remember what I say. And Roshi was pretty emphatic about it. There's, you know, you leave the talk and whatever sank in, you just trust that that's what you were intended to get that day. And if nothing sank in, then nothing sank in. That's fine too. Because you the virtue was participating in the ritual. There's merit in participating in the ritual. The merit is in the ritual, not in, oh, that idea was so good, I have to remember that. It's not in that. It's in that you attended the Dharma talk today. That's where the merit lies. So all of you get full merit for attending this Dharma talk, even if it's all in one ear and out the other, 5 minutes after 11. I hope that's clear, because that's truly how Roshi felt, and that's how he teaches as well. And now I see I need to stop. It's such a pleasure to be sharing these talks with you. And I thank you very much for attending and participating in this ritual, as I am. And I thank the people who attend and participate during the week, and also to my team, Brendan and Brian and Sahar, who work so hard during the week to make this ritual possible. Thank you, and I will look forward to seeing you next week. Bye-bye.